have a terrace garden, and I think my ideal dinner would be to go out and pick the vegetables and the fruit off the terrace and put it together with a few other things purchased in the neighborhood. I'm an omnivore. I like to eat practically anything, but I do like fresh, local, seasonal, organically produced, all of those kinds of things, ingredients, and certainly relatively unprocessed.
This is Shelf Life. In her new memoir, Slow Cooked, Marion Nestle recounts her difficult upbringing as a child of a loveless marriage of impoverished communists in 1930s New York. And she talks about the various twists and turns that led to her extraordinary late flowering as America's best-known nutritionist. Later, we visit one of her favorite books, Sidney Mintz's groundbreaking study, Sweetness and Power, The Place of Sugar in Modern History. Stay with us.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Officials in Minnesota are calling on President Trump to remove federal immigration agents from the state after a Border Patrol officer fatally shot a man during a federal enforcement operation in Minneapolis. Alex Preddy, a 37-year-old ICU nurse, was killed on Saturday, the second such deadly incident this month involving federal agents in the city. Border Patrol Commander-at-Large Greg Bovino addressed the agent's response during an interview with CNN this morning.
What happened leading up to this situation? The suspect decided to inject himself into a law enforcement action. What's not being said here is the fact that Border Patrol agents and law enforcement were conducting a targeted law enforcement effort against a violent, illegal alien that was nearby.
Bystander videos posted on social media appear to contradict the Department of Homeland Security's account of the shooting. A powerful winter storm is bringing snow, sleet, and ice across the eastern two-thirds of the country. NPR's Jeff Brady reports more than 800,000 utility customers are without power.
Utility customers in eastern Texas and northern Louisiana were among those most affected by the storm, according to the website poweroutage.us. Governors in more than a dozen states warned residents about the storm and declared some form of emergency or state of preparation.
Fellow North Carolinians, this is a serious storm. We are taking it seriously, and so should you.
That's North Carolina Governor Josh Stein. His state was among those that asked for, and President Trump granted, an emergency declaration to release federal help. Some parts of the Northeast are expecting up to 2 feet of snow, prompting schools and colleges to cancel classes Monday. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
The Democratic National Committee says it will spend millions of dollars to register voters ahead of this year's midterm elections. Ben Giles reports from member station KJZZ that the DNC will begin its effort in the Southwest.
DNC Chair Ken Martin says the investment is part of efforts to get the party more involved in voter registration. In the past, he says, Democrats have relied on nonpartisan groups barred from discussing the party's candidates or core values. Directly involving party leaders from the national to local level will allow volunteers to better connect with voters that Martin says Democrats have taken for granted.
As we learned in 2024, we can't just assume that certain demographics, whether they be young voters, voters of color, or otherwise, will automatically support the Democratic Party. We have to earn every registration so that we can earn every vote.
Republicans outnumber Democrats by more than 300,000 voters in Arizona. For NPR News, I'm Ben Giles in Phoenix.
This is NPR News. Voters in Myanmar are going to the polls today in the last round of the country's controversial general election. It's being backed by China and Russia, but called illegitimate by the United Nations and the West. Myanmar's military-led party, the Union, Solidarity, and Development Party, has already secured the majority of seats in its national parliament. That's according to the government's election commission. All this while a civil war is ongoing. A U.S. tennis prodigy has eliminated three-time finalist Daniil Medvedev, knocking him out of the Australian Open today. Christina Kugula reports from Melbourne.
It took less than 2 hours for the American 25th seed Lerner Tien to eliminate the Russian former world number one in straight sets, 6-4, 6-love, 6-3. Fighting back the Melbourne Heat and a late comeback by Daniil Medvedev, Tien stunned spectators and his opponent.
Feels amazing. So special. to do it, especially here where, you know, it's always so special for me to come back and play every year.
At age 20, Tien is the youngest man to reach the Australian Open quarterfinals since Australian Nick Kyrgios in 2015, and the youngest American to do so in over two decades. He'll face world number three, German Alexander Zverev, in the quarterfinals Tuesday. For NPR News, I'm Christina Kukolja in Melbourne.
American rock climber Alex Honnold scaled the iconic Taipei 101 skyscraper today in Taiwan. He didn't use any ropes or protective equipment, and it took him about an hour and a half to reach the top. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
I have a terrace garden, and I think my ideal dinner would be to go out and pick the vegetables and the fruit off the terrace and put it together with a few other things purchased in the neighborhood. I'm an omnivore. I like to eat practically anything, but I do like fresh, local, seasonal, organically produced, all of those kinds of things, ingredients, and certainly relatively unprocessed.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. If you sometimes fret that your opportunity to make your mark on the world has passed, take a leaf from Marion Nestle's career. At 50, she found herself divorced, out of a job, and unable to get a credit card. Despite that, she persevered, going back to school, then into government, and finally landing at NYU as Dean of Faculty. Her career-changing book, Food Politics, was published when she was 66, an age when many people might think of retiring. It changed her life. In 2003, a year after publication, she participated in 100 speaking engagements and later received the John Dewey Award for Distinguished Public Service from Bard College. Now aged 86, Nestle is still very much a full-throated advocate for debunking popular food myths and exposing the links between dietary misinformation and a rapacious food industry driven by the bottom line. In her new memoir, Slow Cooked, she recounts both her difficult upbringing as a child of a loveless marriage and the various twists and turns that led to her epiphany that food and nutrition was to be her subject in life. A major part of that has been Nestle's long-standing focus on the impact of sugar on our health, so it makes sense that the book she has chosen to talk about in today's show is Sidney Mintz's groundbreaking study, Sweetness and Power, The Place of Sugar in Modern History. Marion, thank you so much for joining me on Shelf Life.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
I like to hear that. I mentioned in the introduction that you found your calling relatively late in life. In Slow Cooked, you write, I attribute the late start to my career to the prolonged time it took me to recover and move on from my unhappy family's unique way of being unhappy. That's a very powerful line. And I wonder if we can start there with that unhappy family. What made it unhappy, Marion?
Well, first of all, the line was stolen from Tolstoy. It's totally plagiarized. My parents didn't get along. They were members of the Communist Party at a time when that was extremely unpopular, although not nearly as unpopular as it later became. And it's difficult to grow up in a family where your parents don't get along and in which your mother wishes that you were a different kind of child, which she certainly wished for me. So it was a difficult upbringing. My mother was extraordinarily critical of me, not only in the way I behaved, but also in the way I looked and other kind of fundamental aspects of my personality. And we were at war from the time I was a very small child. I don't think that's good for upbringing. And I certainly didn't know how to handle it and didn't learn until I was well into adulthood what I should have done and how I could have handled it better. But I think those things stay with you. And I came out of that experience with no confidence at all. I just thought I couldn't do anything and that I had no, what we now call agency, that I had no choices. And I was just trying to survive, I think. I had good instincts for survival, apparently.
Apparently you do. You mentioned that it was a tough time, the late 30s. You were born at the tail end of the Depression as a red diaper baby. Impoverished Jews who were members of the Communist Party, as you mentioned. I wonder if you've ever seen a relationship between your parents' view of capitalism with the direction of your own career, since so much of that is focused on the association or the impact of the free market on diet and the way we live.
Oh, yes. I mean, I was taught at a very early age about issues of diversity, equality, and the kinds of things that we're all talking about now. And those values made sense to me as a small child. They still make sense to me. And the forces that made it difficult for people to get money. I mean, I came from a very poor family, and you could see the inequalities in income and see how that income was made and see that it wasn't fair to large segments of society. And those were values that made perfect sense then. They still make perfect sense. So, you know, there were other aspects of their political beliefs that did not make sense. And that caused a lot of tension in our family when I was growing up. I used to have political arguments with my parents when I was 6 years old. I mean, come on, you're not going to win those. But I could see, I mean, maybe it's just something inherent in my genetics, I could see the discrepancy between the values that they said they held and the values that they were defending in the Soviet Union. They didn't make any sense to me. They still don't make any sense to me. And yet, you know, I understood later that the party was their social life, it was their religion, it was very, very important to their existence. Their friends were in the party, their enemies were not. And the it's hard to remember what it was like in the 30s and 40s, but it was a very different social environment. And it was also a time when the government was trying to reduce inequality. The 1930s, 40s, and 50s were the period in American life when there was the least inequality that anybody can remember or document. So by the time I got to college, we thought we were changing the world for the better and just didn't understand the extent of the pushback on that.
To stay with you as a child for a moment, we've talked about the sort of impoverished background in which you grew up. What would have been a typical mealtime for you? What would have been put on the table at dinner?
Well, I can hardly remember. I mean, food was not a big aspect of life. It was just there. You know, I mean, there was a vegetable, a starch, and a meat. Most of it overcooked. And, you know, in retrospect, and the vegetables that were available were canned. And we didn't have any money, so we weren't buying fancy food. We weren't going to restaurants except an occasional Chinese restaurant, which I liked very much. And I think I tell the story that the cream cheese and walnut sandwiches on raisin bread at a Chock Full of Nuts were the most delicious thing I could ever imagine eating. And I, you know, whenever I was given money for lunch, that's what I bought. But it didn't become a big part of my life until I was a teenager and later. I learned about food when I went to summer camp, because they had a garden, and that was the first time I'd ever eaten fresh vegetables. Oh, I thought they were wonderful. I really liked them, and still do.
Yeah, you say in the book that Higley Hill, which was a summer camp in Vermont that you get into as a result of your family's communist connections, was the only place you remember being happy as a child. That's a terribly poignant memory. Your father died when you were 13. He was very overweight, I think only 5'10" tall, but 350 pounds, an incessant smoker.
At least, gosh.
I wonder how that impacted your life, losing your father at 13. I mean, you already have a complicated relationship with your mother, and now you're essentially a one-parent, one-child family.
Well, no, I wasn't exactly a one-child family because my mother had adopted a, quote, sister, unquote, who was 18 years old when I was 10. You know, as I said, every family is dysfunctional in its own way, and that was part of it. My mother loved her. And so when my father died, I was abandoned to my mother and the sister, who got married right away very soon afterwards and then wasn't around. And then it was just me and Mom. Until I finished high school and went off to college. You know, it was a very difficult period because we fought constantly. We really didn't get along at all. And, you know, and that's difficult. And when you're not the parent, you lose in those situations. And so it was a losing battle all the way through. And finally, I escaped. And I escaped in the summers when I could go to Higley Hill, which was a very safe, warm and supportive environment with fabulous food, because the couple that ran the camp had lived in China for a long time and they knew how to cook really delicious Chinese food, always with fresh ingredients. And they had an enormous vegetable garden, and there were berries on the property and maple trees that they made maple syrup from, and all of those things. It was really quite wonderful. And so the food aspects of that, I mean, I've met many people who went to that camp since. And in fact, we've collected materials from that camp at the as a special collection at New York University's library. And at the event to celebrate that collection, people who had been campers 50, 60, 70 years before, you know, got up and cried about how unhappy their childhoods were, mainly because their parents were being persecuted, which mine were not. And the camp was their safe haven because they weren't being persecuted. The camp was my safe haven because my parents weren't arguing and because the food was so good. Mm-hmm. And they didn't remember the food at all, which I thought was interesting.
You write in the book that very late in your mother's life, you talked to her about your immensely complicated relationship. What did you learn from that conversation?
Oh, well, I was in therapy at the time, and my therapist said, clean it up with your mom. It was good advice. And so I was living in San Francisco at the time. I went down to Los Angeles and spent several days interviewing my mother. And her, you know, I started out with softball questions about, tell me about your early life, you know, what was it like being a child? And her initial reaction was, well, it's about time you asked. Wow. I thought, oh dear. But I had been trained well not to react. And so I just asked her questions and listened for 3 days and managed to get answers to the questions that I had, which were, where did the adopted daughter come from? What was that about? Why had she been so grief-stricken when my father died, when they hadn't gotten along? And she told me it was because she was relieved that he was finally gone. That seemed kind of amazing.
Wow.
And then I wanted to know why she had been so hard on me. And she said, well, I thought we were very much alike and I had a very unhappy life. And I didn't want you to have the unhappy life that I had. So I wanted to change you. Oh, dear. Okay. fine. And then afterwards, and I didn't put this in the book, but afterwards, she wrote me a letter thanking me for coming down and having this conversation with her, not because of anything that we had talked about or I had done, but because she had finally been able to unburden herself of the fact that she hadn't loved my father, which was something I had known all my life. I didn't need her to tell me that. It was so obvious. So she was remarkably self-centered, and that didn't change. But it was a very, you know, in psychiatric terms, very validating. And I was very glad that I had done it. Cleaned up.
Sage advice for all of us. You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today is the acclaimed nutritionist and author of Slow Cooked, An Unexpected Life in Food Politics, Marion Nestle. Marion, the 1950s were not a great time for women, the period when you were starting your search for a career, for a place in the world. Things would begin to change in the following decade, but you recall going to your 25th high school reunion and finding that hardly any of the women worked, and those that did were helping their husbands. How do you think you were the exception to that broad rule at the time?
Well, I wasn't pretty in the way they were. My three closest friends in high school had as their lifetime ambition to marry a professor, a doctor, and a rabbi, respectively. And I didn't think I had those kinds of choices, so I never had that kind of ambition. I did get married right away, at the same summer that they all got married, which was the summer after our sophomore years in college, but I wasn't very good at it. And once I had children, I was really pretty unhappy staying home with kids. I was not temperamentally suited to that, and was advised by lots of people to go back to school. And it was, even though I came of age at a time when options for women were extremely limited, and you were expected to get married and have children, which I had done, the door was beginning to crack open a little bit so that I could get into graduate school. And I chose to go to graduate school in molecular biology for complicated reasons, having to do with what I had studied as an undergraduate and having particularly admired a professor in the molecular biology department, and thinking that if somebody of his intellectual caliber was in that department, that was the place where I wanted to go. And I could do that, even though the faculty advisor said, well, you know, we're giving you a fellowship because we've got the money this year because no men applied, but if male students apply next year, you're going to lose your fellowship.
Wow.
You know, I mean, but that was so normal. I just didn't think anything of it.
You're at Brandeis University when you have that first big epiphany. You're teaching cell and molecular biology at that point. You're 7 years in when you move from that discipline to teaching nutrition, which you describe as akin to falling in love, though you know very little about it. It's all self-taught for you. How did that transition happen? How did you find that path from molecular biology to nutrition?
Well, it was my first academic job, and I was teaching cell and molecular biology, which I liked very much, but which is extremely abstract and difficult to get the concepts across to students because they can't see it, taste it, feel it. Everything is at the molecular level. You know, you can't see it. And or those microscopes hadn't been invented yet. And the department had very unusual rules for academic departments. It had one that said you could only teach the same class 3 semesters in a row, and then you had to change in order to keep the material fresh, and you had to teach whatever the department needed, whether you knew anything about it or not, because as a doctoral level person, you knew how to learn information very quickly, and you could stay ahead of freshmen and sophomores. This was the early 1970s, and the students had been petitioning the department to teach human biology classes rather than cell and molecular biology classes. And the department said, okay, let's let her do that. It was my three semesters were up. And they offered me a choice of physiology, human physiology or human nutrition. And I was very curious about what was going on in nutrition. There was a lot in the press about it. Frances Moore Lappe had just written Diet for Small Planet. Mm-hmm. Linus Pauling, the double Nobel Prize winner, had just written Vitamin C in the Common Cold. Center for Science in the Public Interest, a nutrition advocacy group that still exists, had just started and had published a terrific compendium of articles on everything about food from agriculture to public health called Food for People, Not for Profit. And that fit into my political views. And I thought, oh, let's do this and let's find out if there's anything to it. And I started preparing the class, and on the first day I prepared the class, I was just so excited about it and thought this was so absolutely amazing that it really was just like falling in love. I thought, this is it. This is the best way to teach biology I could imagine because everybody could relate to it.
I have to say, many times as I progressed through Slow Cooked, I wish that I'd crossed paths with you at a moment when I could have perhaps joined one of your classes. They sounded so fun, but also just this sense that accompanies you throughout this book of pioneering a space that hadn't really existed previously, that this feels very much like exploratory territory, something relatively new, and therefore the sky's the limit. It hasn't all been written about or discussed.
Well, I wasn't aware of that at the time I was doing it. I thought I was just describing the obvious. And it was just that nobody else was paying attention to it except for Center for Science and the Public Interest, which actually became less political as the organization matured. And I was going to all these meetings about childhood obesity, and everybody was saying, how are we going to teach mothers to feed their children better? And I thought, that's ridiculous. Why aren't people talking about how are we going to stop the food industry from marketing junk food to our kids? You know, how are we going to stop that? And that seemed to me the legitimate question to ask. But even I didn't know to ask that question until the early 1990s when I went to a conference on smoking and health and heard people talk about how the cigarette companies marketed to kids and thought, holy smoke, it's the same thing in food. Why aren't we paying more attention to this? I hadn't been paying attention. It was just part of the landscape, you know, all that kind of advertising. And I think it's supposed to be part of the landscape, and you're not supposed to notice it if it's done well. Because the minute you start noticing it, you get horrified and thinking, what are these people doing? They shouldn't be doing this.
You write in Slow Cooked that you found often that beliefs were a stronger influence on human behavior than scientific facts, and that even your own students might adopt a diet based on pure hypothesis. So, for example, taking lots of supplements when the evidence for their usefulness was at best vague and unproven. What are some of the more stubborn food myths that you have encountered in your time that sort of refuse to go away or die?
No, that nutrition changes all the time. That's the big one. You know, I mean, since chronic diseases became prominent sources of death and disability, the advice has always been to eat more vegetables, eat foods that have less saturated fat, salt, and sugar. You know, now it's called ultra-processed foods that are the ones that you're supposed to avoid. But the idea that nutrition advice changes all the time is deeply ingrained in the population. And yet those recommendations have been the same for 70 years now. I mean, they really haven't changed at all. And I think the reason that people think they've changed is because there's so much economic pressure on any recommendation that suggests eating less of a food product. Whoever makes that product doesn't like that recommendation. And just like the cigarette companies did, food companies want to cast doubt on research that links their product to any kind of harm. The other one would be the one you mentioned, which is something that if you eat vitamins, more is better. No! More is not better. Vitamins are meant to be consumed in very small amounts, and supplements are really, really don't make healthy people healthier. Whether they cause harm, we can argue about. Very few of them cause harm, but some do. And it's probably not a good idea to take lots of supplements. Sorry.
You are a skeptic of the idea of superfoods, though we are mad for them, aren't we? Everyone's pounding out almonds and eating kale on the basis that we've been told it's a superfood, better than any other food. But that's not entirely true either.
No, I mean, all fruits and vegetables have vitamins, minerals, and fiber, and they all have something that's useful. The superfood is a marketing concept. I mean, the problem that all of this is dealing with is that in industrialized countries, there's way too much food available and way too many choices. And that makes the food industry extremely competitive. And they have to figure out ways to sell their products in an extremely overheated market. And superfoods sell foods, vitamins sell foods, supplements sell foods. These days, CBD and THC sell foods. I mean, it's kind of amazing. And if you look at these as marketing initiatives rather than anything that have to do with nutrition and health, then you become increasingly skeptical about it. You know, I think it's great if people eat more fruits and vegetables. I don't care which ones you eat. The idea is to eat a variety of them. And then you don't have to worry about your nutrient intake because they'll take care of it. Dietary advice is really very simple and very easy to follow. It's just that there's so much confusion from the marketing that, you know, people throw up their hands and say, you keep changing your mind. We don't.
This is Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with Marion Nessel, the author of Slow Cooked, An Unexpected Life in Food Politics. Marion, you got a real insight into how government works when you scored a 2-year stint as a nutrition policy advisor to the Department of Health and Human Services. This was in the Reagan years, I think. You were put in charge of completing the first ever Surgeon General's report on nutrition and health. Among other things, it was made very clear to you early on that the report would not recommend eating less meat as a way to reduce saturated fats, nor would it recommend eating less foods that were sources of sugar or salt. You found a way to kind of get around that, but a journalist would later accuse you and your generation in general of sort of botching the science of obesity and chronic disease by focusing on fat rather than sugar as a cause of obesity. Was he right?
He doesn't like calories. I'm a calorie person. I don't think it matters what you eat. If you're overeating calories, you're going to gain weight. Some people think that if you stop eating sugar, it solves all your health problems. It actually solves a lot of them. First of all, it reduces the calories that you're eating, and that's pretty useful for a lot of people because most people overeat calories. That's why they gained weight. But I want the calorie context to be there whenever I'm talking about fat or carbohydrate. And I don't really like talking about fat and carbohydrate. I want to talk about the foods that those nutrients come in because people don't eat fat and carbohydrate. They don't mainline salad oil and sugar. They're eating those things with other foods. And the real question is, what does the diet consist of? And how many calories does it consist of? And it's really easy to overeat calories. And we now have a controlled clinical trial that shows that magnificently. There was a trial done at National Institutes of Health in a locked metabolic ward where nobody could cheat. And when the subjects in this study were given what are now called ultra-processed foods, which is the junkiest of junk foods, they ate 500 calories more a day. Mm. 500 calories more a day is a lot.
Yeah.
It's enough to account for a pound of weight gain a week. So to me, this makes the public health implications really clear. Don't eat ultra-processed foods. Or if you do, don't eat very much of them. People can lose weight very easily if they're not eating a lot of junk food. And I saw this when I wrote my book, Soda Politics, that people wrote me afterwards. And I did not write it as a diet book. I wrote it as an advocacy manual, how to get sodas out of school, how to get sodas out of workplaces, that kind of thing. And people told me they lose weight. They lost weight. I read your book, I stopped drinking sodas, I lost 10 pounds. Wow. I read your book, I stopped drinking sodas, I lost 20 pounds. The record was 80. Hmm. And all they did was stop drinking sodas. So that's a good place to start.
As you say, you wrote a book called Soda Politics. It won a James Beard Award. I wonder how you feel about Michael Bloomberg's crusade to reduce our consumption of sugary drinks. Was he on the right track? And why do you think he failed in New York City?
Well, what happened with that campaign was that the city was thinking about putting a cap on sodas over the size of 16 ounces. But they were worried that the soda industry would find out about it. And so they kept it very secret. I thought it was a pretty good idea, but I thought the cap should be 8 ounces, not 16. That would have made a big difference. But it was so badly handled. It's the example that I use about how not to do food advocacy, because it was a top-down initiative and there was no community discussion about it. There was no going around and talking to leaders about it. There was no going around and talking to people who drank a lot of sodas about how they would feel about that kind of thing. And in fact, the communities that were most likely to suffer the diabetes and heart disease effects of drinking a lot of sugary beverages supported the soda industry in that particular battle, and the soda industry won hands down. They took it to court and, you know, got it thrown out on a technicality. But I thought it was very, very badly handled.
Of course, Bloomberg wasn't the only person to be threatened with a suit or legal action by the sugar industry. You encountered that yourself after the publication of Food Politics. You were attacked for associating sugar with fizzy drinks, with sodas.
I was attacked for defaming sugar. I didn't know that sugar had feelings. I hurt its feelings. I was so sorry about that. Yeah, I still laugh about that, because I had said on a radio program when Food Politics came out that sodas contain sugars and nothing else. And the sugar industry got very upset because they said, sodas don't contain sugar. They contain high fructose corn syrup. I can't even say it without laughing, because high fructose corn syrup is sugars. Really, that's what it is. And it's just that they're represented by two different lobbying groups. The Corn Refiners Association does high fructose corn syrup, and the Sugar Association does sugar beets and sugar cane. But, you know, it was kind of an idle threat. And when I read the letter, I just howled with laughter. I just thought it was so funny from its ignorance of biochemistry. But I ran into the head of the Sugar Association somewhat later at a meeting, and I told him how amused I had been by the whole thing and how much fun I was having with it, because I was showing slides of his letter in every talk I was giving. And he said very stiffly, "We're just glad you're speaking more precisely now, because I learned that I had to say sugars plural, not sugar singular." And that took care of it.
Of all the accolades and awards you've received, The most curious was in 2005, you shared a Health Equality Award with none other than Newt Gingrich.
Yes.
To which the follow-up question can only be, what the hell did Newt Gingrich do for health equality?
Oh, at the time, he was a huge proponent of a national health system.
Wow.
I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling. He was right in there trying to get a national health care system for our country, which we do not have. Kind of amazing when you think about what he did afterwards. I've had a very consistent set of values throughout my life, and I don't really understand people who have values like national health care and then go the other way. That makes no sense to me. What changed? Obviously, the politics changed, but, you know, what does he really believe? I don't know.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest on this episode is the author and nutritionist, Marion Nestle. Join us after the break when we talk about one of her favorite books, Sweetness and Power, The Place of Sugar in Modern History.
Architect Frank Gehry died last month. His unique style found curvaceous beauty, blending organic form with modern materials.
We thought we'd invented modern architecture, but then this genius came along. Ooh, different.
Different and exceedingly rare. Why aren't there more North American architects capable of adding that kind of magic to the built environments we all live in? That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. The major snow event is underway and a winter storm warning is in effect for our listening area. The heaviest snow is expected between noon today and midnight. Light to moderate periods of snow possible throughout the day tomorrow with additional accumulation. 16 to 20 inches of snow, 2 feet of snow or more possible in the higher elevations of the Catskills. Road conditions will be difficult to impossible. Avoid non-essential travel. This is Radio Catskill.
Hello, you're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. My guest is the author and nutritionist, Marion Nestle. Her new book is Slow Cooked, An Unexpected Life in Food Politics. We're talking about her favorite book, Sweetness and Power, by the author Sydney Mintz. Marion, some years ago, I was in Ecuador on a bus going through these tiny mountain villages when we stopped briefly at a small shack. It was a tiny settlement on top of a hill. And I hopped out of the bus. I was just curious to see what they might be selling in this shack. And I saw these bricks of brown sugar wrapped in banana leaves. And I bought one. I still have it. I don't know what to do with it, but I use it occasionally as a doorstop. So I was delighted early in Sweetness and Power, which is your book choice for this episode, to discover that this is actually an ancient tradition in those parts of South America. But of course, that was only the tip of the iceberg. This is a monumental book, more academic perhaps than food histories like Mark Kalansky's books on the history of cod and salt, but no less packed with fascinating details. In it, the author, Sydney Mintz, brilliantly fuses the origins and cultivation of sugarcane, the economics of plantation agriculture, the growth of the slave trade, the drive to colonialism, the rise of industrialism, and the marketing of fast food in the 20th century. In short, it's impossible to understate the impact sugar has had on our society. I wonder if we can just start with an obvious question. Do you have a sweet tooth? And if so, what is your sugary downfall?
I have a sweet tooth, and my favorite food is ice cream.
Ooh, mine
too. I like the combination of fat and sugar. You know, I think sugar adds a lot to the pleasure of food. The pleasure of food is extraordinarily important. It's one of life's greatest pleasures. Every time you eat, you get to have pleasure. It's kind of wonderful. And sugar is part of that. And it was fine until people started eating it in enormous quantities, at which point they got tooth decay and were taking in too many calories and, you know, were susceptible to type 2 diabetes and all these other kinds of things. So it's one of those foods that has to be eaten in moderation.
It's hard to imagine a world without sugar as an everyday commodity and a major part of our diet. But as Mintz tells us in his book, Sweetness and Power, there was a time, really not that long ago, certainly not long ago in Europe anyway, when sugar was used only as a spice, the way you might use pepper or use for medicinal reasons. That began to change in the 18th and 19th centuries when sugar exploded in popularity. But I wonder, in a nutshell, can you tell us what made that happen, that change from something that was scarce to something that was extraordinarily popular?
Yeah, Mintz tells us it was the Industrial Revolution, and that when people were forced off the land and into factories but weren't paid very much, the one thing that they could have was tea, and they wanted sugar in their tea. And so, in a sense, sugar became the opiate of the masses. And he tells that story, eloquently in the book. And people like the taste of it. We're born with a taste for sugar because there's lactose in breast milk, and it encourages babies to suckle. Babies don't survive if they don't learn how to suckle right away. And the sweetness is something that they respond to, and we continue to respond to that sweetness throughout life. Mintz talks about the need to supply that sugar, and the way that that need was fulfilled was by slavery, was by sending slaves off to the colonies where they grew sugarcane and harvested sugarcane. And so he ties all of these pieces together. I should say that when I first was at NYU and we were starting our programs in food studies, we had the bright idea of putting together a list of books that everybody in food studies ought to read, a canon, if you will. And we worked on that for some number of months, and at the end of it, it was impossible because there was only one book that everybody could agree on, and that was Sweetness and Power.
Wow.
Which came out in 1985. And I should say that one of the greatest pleasures of my life was teaching a course with Sidney Mintz in Puerto Rico in the early 2000s. We were in Puerto Rico for several weeks, and he gave lectures, and we got to see him honored by the university in Puerto Rico for the work that he had done on showing the importance of Puerto Rican sugar to society in so many ways.
Well, that's a good point to make another observation, which I got from Mintz's book, which is that we associate the sort of sugar industry primarily with the British and the Caribbean, but actually it was the Spanish that first cultivated sugar in that part of the world, in Puerto Rico. And then at some point, the Spanish became eclipsed by the English and to some extent the French in the making of sugar. It's fascinating that this idea of the power of sugar sort of being this very totemic thing. An empire can be built on something as simple as sugar. I found that really, really fascinating.
Well, that's the power of that book, was that he pulled all those threads together in a way that nobody ever had before. And it is considered the prototypical text in food studies. Mintz was an anthropologist, and he brought together anthropology, history, politics, geography, using food as a way to tie all those threads together. And that's really what food studies is about. It's using food as a lens to investigate some of the most important problems in the world. And it's hard to think about a major societal problem that food doesn't connect to in some way. With the obvious ones being hunger and chronic disease and climate change, immigration. I could go on and on.
One of the things that Mintz is interested in is how our ideas of taste have changed. I was stopped dead in my tracks at the description of a dish of oysters that included a sprinkling of sugar and called, rather oddly, oysters in gravy bastard.
I don't remember that, but for good reason.
but though the way we consume sugar has changed, as you point out, studies have determined again and again that we're actually born with a built-in liking for sweet things. I wonder how it can be, or how we can kind of move to a world in which we can have sweet things without also having bad things.
Well, again, it's a question of moderation. There's sugar in everything now. At least in the United States, the sweet taste is so predominant that even if you're having savory dishes, there's sugar thrown on top of them or is in the sauces or is in something because people expect it and they don't like it if it's not sweet. And you go through a supermarket and if you're a label reader, an ingredient list reader, there's sugar in one form or another in vast quantities. Mm. Of supermarket foods. People like it. It sells food. If you cut the amount of sugar down, people don't buy the products. And they want the sugar in the products. They don't want to be adding it themselves. So the real question is, how do you try to encourage people to eat less of something that they really like? That's not so easy to do, and it doesn't get you very far. I want to raise generations of label readers, and it's very easy to teach kids to recognize sugar on food labels and how much there is, and now the food labels make it easier because they tell you how many grams of added sugar there are. You know, that doesn't count the sugar that is put into pre-prepared foods that people buy. And the more we eat in restaurants and the more we buy pre-prepared foods, the more sugar we're buying, often without realizing it. But I don't look at sugar as poison. I'm much more concerned about what the entire dietary picture looks like and what the total caloric intake is like. But the recommendations for sugar intake at 5 or 10% of calories are still pretty generous. And the other part about that is that if you get used to a less sweet diet, a little sugar goes much longer, goes a much longer way. So it takes much less sugar to give a sweet taste if you're not used to eating a lot of sugar.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. My guest is the author and nutritionist, Marion Nessel. We're talking about one of her favorite books, Sweetness and Power, by the author Sidney Mintz. Marion, I grew up in England when it was common to get a sugar mouse at Christmas, literally just boiled sugar and water hardened and molded into a mouse with a string tail. Thanks to Mintz's book, Sweetness and Power, I now understand that this is merely the last remnant of a kind of culinary drama once associated with sugar when it would decorate the tables of kings and queens and the aristocracy. Mintz writes that as sugar became cheaper and more popular, so sugar in such forms as gingerbread houses and candy hearts and candy corn and molded chickens and rabbits, which used to be the playthings of the court and the wealthy, became the playthings of children. Was sugar a plaything in your childhood at all?
I did like crystallized sugar on a stick. I thought that was pretty good. And lollipops, or flavored sugars of one kind or another. I mean, that's all they are. And they're very hard, and hard candies. So maybe those were the United States remnants. But the kinds of things that you're talking about, I never saw when I was a child.
Back to Sweetness and Power. We associate the sugar industry, of course, with the slave trade. Mintz makes a couple of interesting observations. One is that slavery, as far as we know, was also a part of the sugar trade, even in the Arab era, because it was such a labor-heavy process. But he also makes an equation between what was happening in the colonies with the beginning of capitalism. This is where capitalism got its start because of the way that it was organized. I read that and thought that your father, the committed communist that he was, would have found much to admire in Mintz's book.
Well, I think anyone looking at that would look back on it and say this works exactly the same way as things work now. Your objective as a corporation is to keep your costs as low as possible and your profits as high as possible. That's what you're about. And the way I'm always putting it is that food companies are not social service agencies. They're not public health agencies. They're businesses. They're in the business of capitalism. So if they can outsource something to low-wage workers in developing countries in Africa or Asia, that's exactly what they're going to do. And we see this with palm oil. We see this with coffee. We see this with chocolate. You know, we see this with any number of commodities where you keep the wages as low as possible and you add the value within the society where you can get the most money for it. So the people who are harvesting coffee in Africa and Asia are not the people who are roasting the beans and getting them to Starbucks.
So, Marion, you're sitting at home eating a bowl of ice cream, flavor to be determined. This is a pretty academic book. I wonder in your downtime what book you'll be reading that is purely for pleasure.
Well, I actually read books about food and nutrition for pleasure.
Of course you do.
You know, when I said that it was like falling in love, I wasn't kidding. I mean, I just find this stuff fascinating and interesting and exciting and stimulating. And then you get to eat it, which is, this enormous source of pleasure. I just got this week a compendium of articles in which I actually have an article on the commercial determinants of health. And I just couldn't wait to open it and start reading it because it's an entire book about how industries that are related to health influence it, not to the benefit of people, but to the benefit of their stockholders. And the idea that food companies are in it for the money is a concept that's so simple and so straightforward and so unfamiliar to so many people that it bears endless repeating. And it's not that the people who are working in these companies are trying to make Americans fat or unhealthy. They're just trying to do what their job is, which is to return profits to stockholders. There's something wrong with that system. And I think more and more people recognize what's wrong with it, are willing to name it as capitalism or neoliberalism or whatever they want to call it, consumptogenic economic systems, as a committee of the Lancet called it. It's increasingly recognized. 10 years ago, I could not use the word capitalism in a classroom without turning the students off completely. Now I don't have to because they're shouting it from their seats.
Marion, before I let you go, when that tub of ice cream comes out of the freezer, what flavor is it?
Oh, it's vanilla with fruit.
Oh, the best.
Sorry.
No, I'm vanilla through and through. I admire your purity. Marion Nestle, thank you so much for being my guest on Shelf Life. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been a pleasure for me, too.
We've been talking about Slow Cooked, An Unexpected Life in Food Politics by my guest, Marion Nestle, which is published by the University of California Press, and Sweetness and Power, The Place of Sugar in Modern History by Sidney Mintz, published by Penguin Books. More information on the titles we discussed in this episode, as well as others, can be found on shelflifepodcast.net. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and One Grand Books in association with WJFF Radio Catskill. And if you like the show, you can find plenty more on Apple and Spotify, with guests such as Alan Cumming, Orlando Figes, John Waters, and Joyce Maynard. While you're there, consider giving us a 5-star review or rating. It will help others find us.
Sullivan County's social host law, Jared's Law, makes it illegal for anyone 18 or older to provide alcohol or cannabis to minors. Named for a local teen killed in a drunk driving accident, Jared's Law ensures that adults are held accountable, with penalties including fines and even jail time. Parents and guardians are still the number one deterrent to underage substance use, and Jared's Law helps keep our kids safe. Paid for by Catholic Charities.
It's award season, so next time on the Buckaroo Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, we'll hear tracks from all the contenders for the 2025 Folk Music Awards. So join me, please, for the shortlisted albums in the latest British and Irish Folk Music Awards on Sunday afternoon at 3.